You're listening to The Road to Philanthropy with Gary Cohn, a podcast series on giving and working with nonprofits. This podcast is produced by Painted Rock Advisors, a consulting hub providing services to the philanthropic and nonprofit communities. We bring together your values and wealth with opportunities to do good work and make the world a better place. What can we do to help you? Contact us at paintedrockadvisors@gmail.com.
Hi, this is Gary Cohn, and welcome to The Road to Philanthropy, a podcast series on everything in the nonprofit and philanthropic world. Thank you for joining us. So far, our podcasts have focused on major gift fundraising, foundations, nonprofit institutions, and last month, financial services for nonprofits. Today, we turn our attention more to direct program services, and we welcome our guest, Adam Weisberg, Executive Director of Urban Adama, which he joined in 2019. Previously, Adam was the director of the Dillertine Program, executive director at Camp Tawanga, and executive director at Hillel at UC Berkeley. He has an undergraduate degree from UC Berkeley and a master's degree from Columbia University and the Jewish Theological Seminary. Welcome, Adam.
Thanks, Gary. Really a pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, I want to maybe start by sharing with us a little bit about your path from UC Berkeley into the nonprofit world.
I'd be happy to. It's funny, it's a little bit circuitous, or maybe actually when I think about it in retrospect, it's not circuitous at all. It's a fairly direct line, but not one that I would have expected or predicted. When I graduated from UC Berkeley with a degree in English literature, I headed off to Israel for a year on a volunteer service program. And I had every expectation and intention of coming back to the Bay and working for a little bit and applying either to get a PhD in English to go on to be an English professor or to a law degree. And I had no intention or thought of working in the not-for-profit field or in the Jewish world. I spent the year in Israel. That led me to land in a job working with the program I'd been a participant in. I did that for about another half a year in Israel. I then was invited to take a job in New York, helping to coordinate and recruit for the program on this side of the Atlantic Ocean. I did that for about a year and a half. And then I found myself applying to graduate school, really interested in social work, and already having a sense that I really enjoyed and wanted to continue to work in the Jewish community. So I applied to this double master's program at, as you said, Columbia University and the Jewish Theological Seminary, getting a master's in social work and a master's in Jewish studies. And as you can imagine, with those two degrees, I was not going on to be an English professor or an attorney. And when I finished my master's, it led me to all sorts of different work, which has led me to where I am today. I'll quote Steve Jobs, who I think is credited with having said at a commencement address he gave, "You can only connect the dots looking backwards." And when I look backwards, based on my upbringing, my family growing up, the things I was interested in when I was younger and in high school, it actually makes perfect sense to me that I've landed where I am and that I'm as happy and really joyous to be doing the work that I am and living the life that I am. But I never could have predicted that when I was walking across the stage, grabbing my diploma with an English degree at Berkeley.
I got to say, my path's the same way. I never thought I'd be a nonprofit work myself. But here I am.
So here we are.
Your life seems to be centered, you know, on a life based on Jewish values, and they're very important to you. Why is that? Did it come from your upbringing, or where did you really turn to a real strong Jewish commitment?
I appreciate the question and I think about it a lot. I appreciate the question partially because it allows me the chance to honor my mother and my father, both of whom are no longer alive, but are very much present in my life. I grew up in a house that was infused with Jewish values, with a sense of the importance of Jewish community, of the meaning that's found in community. We didn't have a religious home per se, in the typical sense of the word religious, but my parents were very involved. I grew up going to Temple Emmanuel in San Francisco, went to Sunday school through my bar mitzvah, and then actually was, you know, one of those kids who stayed in it through confirmation and actually through Hebrew High one night a week in 12th grade. My parents both served on Jewish community organization boards, and I think that they really set the tone and the tenor. And helped me come to understand very much unconsciously the value and the beauty that's derived from being in community in general. And for me, having grown up with a strong Jewish identity, being in Jewish community in particular, And I will say, I'll give my sister credit as well. She came to have a deep and abiding commitment to an engagement in Jewish life that was very different than my parents fairly early on in her early teenage years. And I really imprinted on that. And I will say, I didn't realize for years how much I'd imprinted on it. But when I look back, I realize what a tremendous role model she was for me in that sphere of my life and how much she's influenced where I am now. I'll just tell an anecdote, and that is that, you know, so my sister also works in the Jewish community in Southern California. And when we were younger and our parents were still alive, my mother would report that friends would say, you know, look at what both your kids are doing in terms of their involvement in the Jewish world. Like, what did you do to have them turn out that way? And my mother, to her credit, her memory should be for a blessing, would report that she would look at them and say, we don't know, but it turned out pretty well, huh?
I actually, you know, I knew what your career was like for a while. I've been following your work at Dillard Teens and then at Urban Automa. I didn't realize who your sister was until I started looking up your bio again yesterday. And I looked up your parents and I said, oh my God, I know your sister. But it's a small world, actually. Well, not such a small world in San Francisco, I guess.
Yeah.
So a question, your work seems to focus on leadership development also, and that you worked with Hillel for so many years and then Dillard Teens, and then Urban Automa has a strong leadership program as part of it. Why is leadership so important to you?
So I'll answer it perhaps in a somewhat roundabout way. I'm actually much less interested in the idea of leadership now than I am in the idea of a word that I've made up, communityship. And what I mean by that is that while I think that obviously thoughtful and impassioned leadership is important, I think that our world right now also needs people learning to be what it means, learning to what it means to be in community, what it means to not need to be in charge, but to be part of the greater whole, right? What it means for us as individuals and groups to actually be greater, for us to make the whole greater than the sum of its parts by showing up sometimes to lead and sometimes to follow. And so my work at both at Hillel and at Dillard Teen Fellows, and to some extent at Tawang and certainly at Urban Adama, has me thinking about how do we help people think about what their leadership qualities are and how they want to make the most of them? How do we help people think about what their followership qualities are and strengths are? And how do we help people think about this idea of communityship, if anybody else likes the word and the idea, so that people are really recognizing that all of us hold multiple roles in different settings and different aspects of our lives. And what it's really incumbent upon us to do is to recognize what is needed of me here. How can I make the greatest contribution? When do I step up because that's what I'm being called to do? And when do I step back because that's equally important? And I do think particularly, even though I know that there is great pressure, particularly on teens and young people to demonstrate how they are quote unquote leaders, because that's what people think they're gonna be rewarded for, I'm very much invested in helping people think about where they wanna lead and where they wanna follow and where they simply wanna participate and how all those things come together.
That's a very good perspective on that. I mean, team building and being a team player, we talk about being a team player, but not everybody knows how to be a team player. And that's a great aspect of that. Tell us a little bit about Urban Adama and what you guys do there.
Happy to. So Urban Adama is a Jewish community center and farm. We're on 2 acres in West Berkeley on 6th and Harrison. And we, our mission is to create more loving, just, and sustainable communities. And we do that through work in what we call 4 worlds, the world of Jewish values, the world of sustainability, the world of social justice, and the world of mindfulness. And ideally, when we're doing our work really well, at least 2, if not more, of those worlds are integrated through the experiences that we provide, through the community that we create, and through the way we come together with and bring people together. So you can imagine when I say community center and urban farm, we do many of the kinds of things that you would associate with either of those kinds of organizations. So we do have, as I said, a 2-acre site with about 1 acre of which is under cultivation. And we grow literally everything you can imagine on a Northern California farm. So everything from carrots to kale and apricots to apples in our orchard and all the other kinds of crops you would imagine, as well as flowers. We have bees, we have chickens, we have goats. So in that sense, we grow a lot of produce. And of the 15,000 pounds or so of produce that we grow each year, 90% of that goes through food distribution partners who we work with out to folks in the community who experience food scarcity and food insecurity. At the same time, in parallel, we're running a whole host of programs. So we run a three-month resident fellowship for young adults, where they live on the farm for 3 months and learn about sustainable agriculture and learn about Jewish values and learn about a whole host of things that we think help people be more thoughtful community members and more thoughtful human beings in the four worlds that we inhabit. We run a summer camp, normally with up to 80 kids in a session. This summer, it'll be 40 kids in pods just to be COVID safe. We're currently running an after-school program for 30 kids in three pods to give kids and families some respite from COVID. We run a whole series of educational and experiential and celebration programs, one-off programs, multi-session programs, programs on urban farming. And then we host a Kabbalat Shabbat, a Friday evening service once a month, normally on the farm, now virtually, as well as festivals and celebrations for all of the major Jewish holidays.
You mentioned about food insecurity and the impact of that. I was on the board of the SF Food Bank for about 7 years. And even back then, we actually took a couple acres of land out at the cemetery that Emmanuel owned out in Colma, and we grew vegetables on it. Nothing like you guys are doing in Urban Adama, but certainly our people went out every week and did that. What is the importance or the impact, maybe I should say, the impact of COVID-19 on your work?
It's interesting. I would say the biggest impact has been that we are very much a place and space-based organization. We are all about and very dedicated to bringing people to the farm to put their hands in the soil. Even if they're not coming for an urban farming program, we make great efforts to get people out into the fields, right? If it's on Friday night and Kabbalat Shabbat, we will invite people during the silent prayer period, right, of personal reflection and contemplation, either to stay in the tent doing guided meditation or to go out somewhere on the farm and put their hands in the earth. So in that sense, COVID has meant that we've had to figure out how to reinvent ourselves so that we're continuing to bring meaning and value to the Urban Adama community, even though it's all virtual and on the screen. And that's been a pretty significant transformation for us. That said, we've run about 160, 170 programs over the last year, all virtual. It's been nice in that we've had, instead of having participants only from the greater Bay Area, we've had Bay Area folks as well as folks from as far away as Alberta, Canada, yesterday in a program, as an example. So that's been a great thing. I will say that there are no upsides to COVID, but if I had to point to something that approximated an upside, it's that COVID has forced us to rethink who we are and what we do and how we can do it in the most meaningful way. And that's led us to some really, I think, exciting innovation that I think will serve us well beyond COVID in terms of how we think about our work, how we deliver our work, how we refine our pedagogy to make sure that our programming is really influenced by our core values and not just programming that we're doing because it's easy and it meets, you know, some interest group.
You know, today, many, many young people who are, you know, overwhelmed in some ways with social media and iPhones and all the things that go with it are being drawn back to urban farming and organic food issues. Why do you think that is? What's drawing them back?
I think it's a couple things. One is, you know, I would say it's all of us, right? I'm not a young person, right, at 57, but I also get consumed with technology, particularly during COVID. It's very hard to get off it. I always think it's a little ironic when older folks say, like, I wish my kids would get off their phone, you know, and before they can get the sentence out of their mouth, right, we're picking up a call that's coming or we're checking a text message. So, you know, the irony should not be lost on any of us. You know, I think that there is a recognition that all of the systems that we have been working under for a long time and that we have told would either liberate us or elevate our experience of life are not panning out in that way, right? You know, we are at a critical juncture, I think, in human experience in this country, where we are recognizing that many of the economic systems that we have been raised to believe serve all of us, in fact, serve a relative few of us. I think that, you know, that we are in a moment of reckoning and have been for a while now, where many people have known for a long time, and too many of us are only coming to acknowledge, if not learn, acknowledge now, that the systems of, you know, of apportionment of resources and of access to resources and access to power and influence has been structurally and systemically limited to a very narrow margin of society, and a lot of people have been excluded. And I think that the recognition that the systems that we've been living under are not serving the greater good in the way that we have come to believe or have convinced ourselves of, has people, particularly younger people, who are not set in their ways and who have less to protect in some ways, at least financially, has led those folks to say, wait a minute, this is not what, this doesn't reflect my values. It doesn't reflect the values that I was raised to believe guide my community and my society. I need to find some other way of being in relationship with my fellow human beings and with the earth. And I also think that, you know, that young people and some older people recognize that, you know, to go back to a language I used before, when you put your hands in the soil and let them rest there or let them work it, you almost by definition have a different experience of what it means to be alive. And I know that that's a grand statement, but I really mean it. And it's not just that you, I think it's not just that you realize there's a difference in being alive in that moment when your hands are in the soil, when you're tilling the earth, when you're harvesting, when you're planting. I think that it sticks. And I think that it slows our nervous system. I think it gives us a space to be more conscious of who we are and who we aspire to be. Not what we aspire to be, but who we aspire to be, what our deepest held values are, and how we might get closer to living them as opposed to just thinking about them. And I think that that's what makes programming at Urban Adama and other similar places really compelling, not just for young people, but for people of all ages. I mean, I will tell you that, you know, if we have a volunteer Sunday, right, when we're really back to them, COVID, you know, I hope being a thing of the past relatively soon, you know, our volunteer Sundays have as many people in their 60s as they do people in their 20s or 30s. And that to me is very telling about where people are looking to find deeper meaning and greater sense of community.
You said that you're being raised by your parents. They were very much involved in nonprofit boards and the community. What are your thoughts about the importance of volunteering and charitable giving for that matter?
So I'll go to Jewish sources here to answer your question, because it's where my mind and my heart go. You know, in terms of giving, right, there is a teaching from Jewish tradition that says even the recipient of tzedakah, right, even the recipient of somebody else's generosity is responsible for giving tzedakah, right? The Jewish notion, the sages, right, our teachers of you know, centuries and thousands of years ago, recognizing that if we look around for a moment, we will always find somebody who has greater need or at least equal if different need than we have. So I believe deeply in the value of tzedakah, of giving from what we have. I think that the more privilege we have, the greater our responsibility. You know, the reality, and you know this from your work, is that it is often the case that people with less give more, and people with more give less, at least relative to what they could give. So I actually think it's an imperative. I think it's, you know, it's very telling that the Jewish word, right, for what is translated as charity, tzedakah, doesn't mean charity. It does not come from a sense of, you know, what makes of caritas, right, of generosity. Well, generosity, wrong word, right? It comes from the root word tzedek, meaning justice, meaning giving is actually doing justice. So that's on the giving side. And in terms of volunteering, you know, again, I would go to the sources, right? The Hebrew, lo alecha hamlacha ligmor, right? It is not our responsibility to complete the task, right, of fixing the brokenness of the world. But the next line, right, in that teaching says, but neither are any is any one of us free to desist from it. So what it means is that each one of us has something to give. We need to figure out what that is, and then we need to do it. And that is our labor, right, and our, you know, our intelligence and our thoughtfulness and the work of our hands and our hearts, as much as it is giving to those who are in need of our cash assistance.
And that is crazy, but the last quote you just gave actually was on Blue Blood, the TV show last week, where the Catholic character actually quoted that, and someone in the scene said, where'd that come from? And he said, the Talmud. I was cracking up. It was all part of the game. Right. My last interview that actually before you was with the CEO of the food bank of Silicon Valley, a dear friend of mine who, she was at the food bank in San Francisco when I was there on the board. And I was telling her, I remember when my daughter was 8 or 9 years old that we went down to the food bank for our weekend volunteering, and they gave us this gigantic crate of kiwi to separate and clean and move on so they could give them out to people. Mm-hmm. And, the importance of volunteering, I think, as a family also has that those strengths in it also, and that our kids learn from us what our mentoring does for them. What excites you about the work at Urban Automat? What gets you up in the morning and says, yeah, I can't wait to get to do this today?
It's a pretty long list. I'll try to just hit the highlights. One piece, it goes back to what you said before, right? That I think that the work we're doing feels very compelling to a lot of people. I think the opportunity to be in a space where one's nervous system slows down. I think the opportunity to contribute to an effort to create something akin to an oasis in our urban centers, being able to be part of the effort to create that space that other people can come to and then co-create with us and contribute to feels very important. I'll mention that we're one of the organizations working with the Federation on what Federation is calling community of belonging. They didn't come up with the phrase, but they're doing a lot of work around community belonging. The idea being there's a difference between Urban Automat creating programs and then inviting people to come and participate and then leave, right? And that's transactional. And it is not nearly as deep as creating a community of belonging where people are coming to a place where they actually feel a sense of greater investment, of greater community, of greater connection, and actually feel like partners in creating something. I feel like Urban Automat is either inching or leaping its way or our way towards being a community of belonging where people feel like they have skin in the game, like they're contributing to something that will be ennobling for them and will be ennobling for others. So the opportunity to go and work with a really, really passionate and smart group of colleagues every day, the opportunity to work with a board of directors that is deeply invested in our work, particularly the work of creating community and sustaining community and including as many voices in defining what that community is as possible, that to me is just inspiring. And then there's just the fact that, you know, when even on Zoom, right? So when I go to the farm a year ago, when I would go to the farm a year ago for Kabbalat Shabbat on Friday nights, I would leave transported to another place. The music, the singing, the intention, the ruach, the energy was just transformational. And I will tell you that at our best moments, even when we're doing that on Zoom, there still is that quality. There still is that energy. There still is the love and the affection and the investment. And that feels great. And when I'm on the farm occasionally these days, because I'm not working there, because like everybody else, I'm working from home. But we do have staff who are working on the farm. Our farm team is there. Our facilities team is there. And our youth and family programs director is there leading a staff of six part-time folks who work for us with us running our after-school program. When I'm there on a weekday now, and I get to see 30 kids running around, singing, playing, you know, collecting the eggs from our 17 chickens, that brings me a lot of joy because I watch other people experiencing joy, and joy is in such short supply these days that if we're able to create the opportunity for more people to experience it, I feel like that's contributing something. It's a very small something, but it's something that feels very important in the world right now, which for many of us too often feels really bleak.
One of the things you said, I think is really right on point, which is that too many people live in a transactional world today. Certainly in the Jewish world had turned that way in a lot of ways. And I did a lot of work with Ron Wolfson on relationship Judaism and the idea that you belong to a community, you're there for the community, you're part of the community. It's not just buying the bat mitzvah, the bar mitzvah for your kid. It's we're going to be there when you need it. And I think that's very, very important of what you're talking about on that. So let me head away from Urban Automat. What do you do when you're not working? What do you like to do?
You know, I think I have to answer that question the way I think many of us would after a year of COVID. You know, what do you mean when I'm not working? Now, I want to be clear. That's my fault. That is not Urban Automat's fault. Right? I'm not being asked to work more than I did before. But, you know, when your office is your bedroom, is et cetera, it's very easy to get sucked into the work because the work is there. The work needs to get done. It's compelling. It's also a distraction from the ills of the world, which have been so manifold, in the last months. But that said, it's interesting. I've gone through cycles over the last year where I become aware of the fact that I'm working more than is being asked of me and more than is good for me or the world or even Urban Automat. And then I track back from it and then I fall into it again. I track back. But when I'm not doing that, I love to ride my bike. I love hiking and backpacking and camping, really anything outdoors. I've gone on more walks in the last year, whether it's around the block or around the neighborhood, whether it's with, you know, a friend socially distanced or one of my daughters, than I have in a long time. And that's been really, really wonderful and nurturing, self-nurturing. I love to read. I do a little bit of writing here and there. And then I try to spend as much time as I can with really dear friends, just connecting and nurturing friendships, because they make me feel good about being available to and present in other people's lives. And other people's presence in my life leads me to be more thoughtful, more generative, and more joyous. And again, these days, that feels really, really important.
Well, one of the things I do miss about the Bay Area, we lived in Montclair for years, 30 years. We could go up the hill two minutes and be in Redwood Park, or come over to Tilden, and just gorgeous. I don't have that in LA. The hillsides are bare. they may be alive with music, but they're bare, yeah. As they say. If people want to get involved in Urban Adama or support you in some way, how would they go about doing that?
So I would invite people to go to urbanadama.org. It's urban, the way it sounds, ADAMAH.org. The first thing I would say is look at the program offerings that we have, all virtual now, unfortunately, although we hope we'll be back in person, at least small scale, sometime soon. But take a look and see if there's anything we're offering that seems of interest. And I would encourage and invite people to, you know, to sign up for a program, register and join us. I will say there are a number of things that I'm really moved by that we're doing right now. One of them is that we're doing a whole program series on Shemitah being the sabbatical year in Jewish tradition, where in the land of Israel, you work the land for 6 years and then you actually let it lie fallow for a year in the biblical tradition. And so we're doing a whole program series with a whole bunch of guest facilitators and teachers looking at the different elements of Shemitah. So the idea of land justice, of economic justice, social justice. And I think we've brought in a really interesting mix of folks teaching all sorts of different things. So I would invite people to check that out if that's of interest. We are, I hope, going to run another urban farm series, four-part urban farm series soon. People are invited to do that. So programmatically, I would say look at the website and see if there's anything that strikes your fancy. And then I would say, you know, look, given that one of my jobs is to be the primary fundraiser for the organization, if there are people who have listened to this and think that what we're doing sounds interesting, I would invite people to, you know, find my contact info on the website and reach out. I'm always happy to give people a tour, whether it's virtual or in person, socially distanced and masked. I'm always happy to talk more about the organization and answer people's questions. And if there's somebody who was thinking, wow, I've always wanted to start something that sounds sort of like Urban Adama, I would welcome that outreach as well, so that we can think together about how people might do something that would be meaningful for them in the community, that would be in some way, you know, parallel to what we do.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for taking part in our podcast series.
Of course. And, thank you for the opportunity, Gary.
Look forward to visiting with you up there in the coming months.
Very much hope we can do it sooner as opposed to later.
Thank you for listening. We want to stay connected with you. Be sure to stay connected with our community by giving a like to our Facebook page and following our Instagram @PaintedRock_advisors. Our podcast is available on all of your favorite platforms. We'll see you at our next release.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.